papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city.
Welcome to the Media Project, an inside look at media coverage of current events. I am not Rex Smith. I'm Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady, and now I'm vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. With us today is Barbara Lombardo, former editor of the Saratogian and adjunct professor at the University of Albany, Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussfeld, and Media Project producer David Gustina is back with us. Thank you all for being here today. So let's start with trust. This is a big issue in the media, and I've ended my week here thinking, who can we trust nowadays? What brings this to my attention is all the kerfuffle over the Kate Middleton photograph that she released showing her with her children. It followed months of speculation about, where is Kate? Is she okay? She had some sort of surgery, Kensington Palace says, but come to find out, the image, the photo that was released and distributed worldwide on the Associated Press on Reuters was doctored. And it was doctored in such a way that even the Associated Press and Reuters withdrew it from public. They issued a kill notice, which is highly unusual. So this was an officially released photograph, which typically the media would take as real. Where are we in this world now when we can't even take a palace photograph and trust it anymore? David, what do you think?
I think we're sort of crossing the Rubicon in many ways when it comes to the ability to digitally edit photos. Although the article points out, the doctoring of photos has gone on since photography was invented, including the little girl with the dancing fairies, if anyone that recalls to anybody's mind. That's in the article, Judy. I did read it. But the whole point is that they come down to this, what is a photo anymore? And if we've lost trust in journalists and journalism and some of our other institutions, now seeing is no longer believing. And that's one of the things that you would say was the most trustworthy. Here's the picture, can't lie.
There's something going on here that's beyond journalism and beyond how this picture was handled specifically. Because this whole health issue with the royals, with the current king has cancer, they've announced that, but they don't say what kind of cancer other than it's not prostate cancer. And now you have Middleton who goes in for abdominal surgery and is not telling anybody what kind of surgery it is. The whole thing is mysterious. I saw something online that brought in a potential rift between the prince and the princess. Who knows if that's accurate? But the English people spend a lot of money on their royals, and they don't want to lose their royals, but they do deserve more honesty and transparency than they're getting here.
I see this through a slightly different lens, but I think that this was an innocent error of judgment on the part of Kate Middleton, that she is putting out a photo and that she is used to doctoring her own photos to make the, she wants a nice family picture to release to the public. So she alters it to make it look to her satisfaction, and then she sends it out. That it's possible that it doesn't occur to her that the authenticity of this photo is really critical. So it goes out, and then the media do the right thing. They look at it and say, jeepers, after it's been widely distributed, they look at it and say, jeepers, this isn't right. You can tell by the location of the arms or a sleeve and things like that, that this has been a doctored photo. So the first thing that they do, which I think was the right thing, was to remove the photo, because you don't know at what stage it's doctored. You don't know how it was changed, by whom and why. Okay, so now we need to have that standard where if there's a photo that's doctored, we know to remove it. But then, was this nefarious? I don't think so. It turns out she doctored it. I think it's a communication thing. Ira, the issues you bring up about the openness of the royal family are legitimate, but for the issue of the photo, I don't think it's a big deal.
You're very trustworthy on this, Barbara. It's not like you. I haven't heard anybody use the word jeepers since a Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movie in the 40s.
But the photo itself has spawned so many conspiracy theories that even White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre was asked the question, does the White House doctor any photos? I mean, we in the news business, we have taken provided photos, as we call them, and published them for decades. How reliable are they? How reliable is anything that we receive, any video? What steps do we need to take to authenticate what we get to make sure what we're passing off to the public as information is truly accurate?
Yeah, and journalism has to tackle this problem. We have to find ways, photography and video, to either watermark it or somehow have an indication as to whether it's legitimate or not. You can see why Charlie Warsaw wrote in The Atlantic, experts have reasoned that technology might become so good at conjuring synthetic media that it becomes difficult for anyone to believe anything they didn't witness themselves.
And people don't believe things they saw themselves.
That's right.
I mean,
even eyewitness reports are the most...
The January 6th insurrection, you watched it on television, and now... The collective amnesia that you called to our attention last week.
Right.
Judy.
You know, and former President Trump is now maintaining that some of the statements that are being aired allegedly that he made, he did not make, that were in fact generated by artificial intelligence when they were in fact said by Donald Trump. I expect we will see far more of that going forward.
Yeah, and it's already all of it's muddled because it started with this idea that he was accusing the media of being fake. You know, you can't trust anybody in the media. So you start that going, and then you add in these other little elements we're talking about, including AI, and you can see why it's going to be a very, very difficult future in journalism to ferret out legitimate information.
New research is suggesting that even as people start tuning into the upcoming election, they could end up more misinformed, not less, as they try to fact-check the world themselves. I've come across this way too often with friends and family who will say, well, I'll do my own research on COVID vaccine reliability, on what Biden's proposal with Social Security are. How do you counter that, and what role should the media be playing?
Well, and how do you counter the mistakes that I think the media made in the prior elections when Donald Trump, now using Truth Social, says something outrageous like that things that were true are lies? And not that many people are actually seeing that, and yet we give it legs by, we in the mainstream media give it legs by saying, oh, look what Donald Trump said on Truth Social about the videos about him being false, when in fact they are true. And so we're wasting, I think we're giving him more free publicity. He says is not, and we say is too, and he says is not. I don't think that serves a purpose. It's just, should the media be doing that?
Which part?
The correcting, taking what he says on Truth Social, telling the public what he says, and then saying, but his claims are false. How often should you do that versus just ignoring it?
Well, you should certainly do it when he's live on the air, like CNBC did not, and allowed him to spew lie after lie after lie and did not check him at all. Meanwhile, you see people like Seth Meyers and Jon Stewart and others who go through each and every allegation over and over and over again. And it's overwhelming. It really draws the perspective that we have forgotten a lot about what went on during the Trump years.
CNBC interview reminds us of the fact that you really can't air Trump live. You have to interview him and then edit him. I agree with you about the late night talk show host doing a pretty good job of stringing these things together and reminding the American public about what he says and how he says it. Although I will take exception to Jimmy Kimmel and reading the Truth Social post.
That was fabulous.
It drew attention to him. It gave him the attention. I know he had a joke at the end, but it was a short joke. Wasn't that great a joke? You disagree?
Well, it wasn't that great a joke. But it was while it was happening now, and I think it was appropriate for that moment.
I mean,
but when you said about CNBC that it's a reminder of the lies, I think it's a reminder of where the media is once again falling short. And Oliver Darcy from CNN wrote a very good article about that interview. You would have thought that it was the Joe Kiernan's first day on the job, that he just got sucked into letting Trump ramble sounded like a newbie reporter, but he got stepped all over, and nobody forced him to be in that position. So he and his bosses at CNBC are culpable, and the more that happens, the worse off the public is going to be.
And Barbara, even when it's not live on the air, when it's a report that comes out, like Ben-Hur's report, and we have time to read it, and then we go right to this one comment, which many have argued was inappropriate, about Biden, his memory, and a feeble old man trying to make good. We find out that when you really read through it, there is an equally positive comment about his photographic memory to remember his house. So, you know, even when we have time, because we see that that's a hot story, maybe we cover the memory issues or the dementia issues rather than putting it in full context.
Right. They released it late in the day, and the reporters were anxious to get a little piece of airtime in the prime time, and that's what happened with that. And it reminded me of the Bill Barr press release about the Mueller report back in the day,
right,
where people just seized on this one part, and it really mischaracterized the report and its findings. We did not learn that lesson, and I, you know, I'm not optimistic that we'll learn the lesson going forward.
Thus, you know why then so many people were shocked at the State of the Union after this 24-hour pummeling of President Biden and his memory, and is he going to make it to the next election? He's going to have to pick someone else to run for him at the convention, and then all of a sudden he comes out, oh, look, it's not what they've been saying at all.
So that's what the follow-up headlines said, in essence, like, quote, Biden, not as lame as depicted, transcript shows, and it does not have the power of the initial report.
Bill Maher said, proof of life.
Yeah. Oh, that's kind of clever.
Well, I'm going to get back on my horse, and bearing in mind that the name of this program is The Media Project, we keep falling, we in this room and others in other panel discussions that I've been a part of, the operative phrase is the media screwed up, or the media should be doing this way, the media should be doing that way, or here's how the media handled it. And my argument is, some, use the word some, there's no one thing as a media anymore. And I used to get, a little tiny newspaper in upstate New York, I would get mad when I was tarred with the same feathers that the New York Times or CNBC or whatever big outlet was tarred with. We're different. There are any number of media outlets out there, and we need to be careful when we castigate the media as a collective entity.
But it's true.
Hang on a second. I just want to say, Ira, I'm really sorry.
Well, I was
You're so
about...
right.
It's well, true. But there are some media outlets that are far more powerful and drive the conversation. I think cable news outlets do that. I think national publications like New York Times and The Washington Post do that. And oftentimes, the smaller publications will follow that lead. Well, or AP as well. I mean, they'll put the AP stories on the front
I'm not
page.
Sure. I think when people use the phrase the media, they refer to the cable news outlets. I think that the most exposed part of the media, it's where many people get their news now, social media aside. And that's, in my view, is when they talk about the media, they're talking about MSNBC, CNN,
yes,
or Fox News.
And let me just add to that, Ira, because, you know, Fox to the right, yeah, MSNBC to the left, CNN was sort of seen as a little bit more toward the middle. Then you can pick your other publications, including online publications that serve the left and the right and the middle. And these are different. You have to really go organization by organization. Now jump down to a regional organization like WAMC or a local organization like the Daily Freeman. There are different practices. Even though we are all sharing journalism, we're not all covering it exactly the same way.
I'll consider myself reasonably chastised by my former colleague.
I'm not your boss anymore. You don't have to.
That's right. As the editor of a paper that was even smaller than the Kingston Freeman. However, people who are readers have a similar disdain and distrust of the media, no matter what the size. And they have issues with the local media as well as the big guys.
There's always been a little bit of that. But I think Pew Research has done some studies that show that at least they have more trust in their local newspaper, their local radio station, and their local television station than they do in the national media, in part because oftentimes they know the local reporter. They know the owner of the paper. So there's a little bit of trust there.
Yes, I think the studies have also shown that while journalists consider themselves the watchdog of the people, that the kind of description that they could have just taken out of my own diary of what we're trying to accomplish here, that we have civic pride, we're trying to do the right thing, and yet there's skepticism on the part of the public that we're really just after our own good, we're not really looking out for their good. depressing.
Can I take a moment to recognize the fact that we're taping this in the middle of Sunshine Week? And so Sunshine Week is a, you know, we in the media, I tend to hate weeks, like, you know, it's appreciate your dog week. But in this case, I make an exception. Sunshine Week is meant to celebrate the efforts of the media and everyone makes about how important transparency is when it comes to government. And it helps people make better decisions. It helps people understand more why government is doing what they're doing, but it is increasingly coming under attack. It's harder and harder for news media who are stressed by lower workforces to actually push for the transparency that our society needs so often. So
skies are cloudy?
Skies are indeed cloudy when it comes to the Sunshine Act. Oftentimes, our only recourse to getting information we need is to go to court, and it's often just far too expensive, especially for a newsroom that is really financially stressed.
You know, when I have an argument with my wife, I'll say to her, to cut off the argument, you'll miss me when I'm gone. And that's what you're seeing now, and even in the smaller communities, or maybe especially in the smaller communities, where there are no reporters covering these town board meetings or other municipal meetings, and there have been studies that have come out that show that the unattended by reporters' meetings, more money is being spent or more things are happening that the public is never going to find out about. And talking about transparency and sunshine, even if they intended to be transparent, there's nobody there to report on what's going on.
And even if you make a Freedom of Information request, a FOIL request, you could be delayed for years. You know, there's tactics that they use to get around ever getting you the sunshine in time.
And I've experienced what you're talking about, David. But beyond that, there are also the times when a news organization is going to end up going to court to fight for the records that they believe are public. And when it turns out that they are public, there are laws now that reimburse the entity that's suing and force the government entity to pay up for the lawyer's fees to cover the cost of having to bring a lawsuit that they shouldn't have had to bring in the first place. And there was a story the other day that more than $1.6 million in attorney's fees were paid by local governments. It doesn't say which local governments, but say that's nationwide. I don't know how that was spread out.
So,
that's a lot of dough.
What do the taxpayers think about that?
So let's go at it a little bit, Ira. I think that it could be a campaign pitch for people to run against incumbents in small communities to say, hey, this guy refused to give information that the public should be able to see, and it cost you, the taxpayer, $1 million, $100,000, whatever it is, that they should be told that and that it could help the opposition to those people. What do you think?
You know, I happen to agree with you that that is a way that it can be turned. But my own experience is that it happened on more than one occasion when we would go to court and try to get court fees as part of the judgment, that people would blame the newspaper for taking their government to court and costing the government money to defend itself and whatever else is involved. So, sure, if the candidate for mayor has been somebody who has been not transparent, his or her opponent can take advantage of that. But there's that other side that people believe that the media is spending their money and it's a waste of money.
Right. And there's the third side to that, which is that the politician goes, well, you know, the county's going to pay for this or the city or the state, you know, so I will just refuse this request.
Right.
We'll fight it. I don't have to pay the money. But you as the publisher or the newspaper don't want to pay any money. You just want the information.
Right. And you have to prevail in order to get attorney's fees.
It's not easy
to prevail, and you have to put up the upfront cost. And again, most news organizations, especially local ones, do not have the wherewithal to do that. You know, when I was doing editorial interviews with candidates, I would always ask transparency questions or open government questions, but it's not an issue that politicians usually run on, and it's not one that resonates with the public, and it should. I don't think most people understand how important it is.
Can you call on me, teacher? Yeah, there is a politician in New York State who ran on transparency, and her name is New York Governor Kathy Hochul. She said she was going to have the most transparent administration yet in New York State. And yet, I can't seem to find any press contacts on her website, and we don't get timely responses from her press people. Strange.
we can be in dark times when it comes to public transparency, I think, at all levels of government. And it doesn't seem like it's going to get much better. I think New York State's freedom of information law should be overhauled with more levers that the media can pull to get the information that the public is rightfully entitled to.
Well, the lawmakers themselves are often the worst at keeping themselves not transparent.
Yeah, and they're not going to pass the laws to do that.
Right. The law in many cases applies to everybody except the legislators themselves.
We also need to address this TikTok effort. As we sit here, a bill that would require TikTok to divest itself of ownership by the Chinese Communist Party has been passed by the House and is going to the Senate. But there's a lot of talk about whether or not that's a freedom of speech issue. What role should the government take in requiring TikTok to divest itself of ownership? Have we seen this? And at the same time, we see in Britain a move to deny Jeff Zucker and his Emirati backers to acquire London's Daily Telegraph. So what role should the government play, if any, in regulating who owns media companies?
Well, it's a tough one. I happen to like TikTok as a user. I've decided that I'm the oldest user of TikTok, but I do think that there are First Amendment concerns here. I think that people, like with anything else they read or absorb or watch or listen to, have to do so with a critical eye so that they're not being suckered in, and they should be looking for second opinions if something strikes them as odd. Beyond that, the content itself is secondary because of the Chinese government has the ability to gather information about us that perhaps we wouldn't want to have gathered about us. I happen to not want to wave the white flag about this, but I suspect that my information is well out there on any other number of online apps. So it's a long answer to saying I don't think this bill should have passed.
Yeah, I think they're singling them out. You know, when it comes to social media and the damage that social media is doing, as some argue, I think appropriately, to children, especially teenagers and young girls, it's not just TikTok that is responsible for that. It's more than that. As far as the issue of China tracking us, I think that's a legitimate thing to be worried about for sure. But, you know, how many Russian bots have been doing the same thing that they did in the 2016 election? We've got these kinds of things we need to worry about coming from all directions. So to cite just TikTok, I think, again, like Ira says, it's not really going to solve anything.
I think we're in a global world where the ownership of media companies, just like property and other types of businesses, are going to be owned in full or partially owned or substantially owned by entities from all different countries. And this is really above my pay grade to be able to intelligently comment on what ought to happen to those entities. However, I think that one thing I do have an opinion on is that the media, and it would have to be the bigger guys, should be covering this very thoroughly and getting ahead of what does all this mean, and having ongoing, not just one-shot reporting, but ongoing reporting about these issues and helping the public understand who owns what and who is controlling what.
You know what I think is interesting? Judy used the phrase before, Chinese Communist Party, and I've heard that used a lot in the last few days regarding TikTok. The use of the word communist had essentially gone away. It was the Chinese government or with Beijing, whatever you want to call it. All of a sudden, and I mean, it's not blaming Judy. This is widely discussed as an issue now between the United States, Congress, TikTok, and the Chinese Communist Party. I thought that word had disappeared.
That is interesting. Reminds me of the Republicans who will talk about the leftist, the radical leftist, democrat. Like socialists.
Well, and talk about the redefinition of words, that socialism in many ways for the Republicans, the conservative Republicans, equates to communism.
You know, we need to be mindful that TikTok has become an important source of news and other kinds of information for a large portion of our population. Also, it can be valuable. I draw your attention to Jonathan Katz. He's a former AP reporter who's now, he's an independent journalist, so he's out there on his own. He's the one who uncovered Alabama Senator Katie Britt's misleading information that she included in her response to the State of the Union. He put out a TikTok video that clearly showed why what she was saying about the woman who was sex trafficked by Mexican cartels, and that 12 years ago, he clearly explained how this was wrong, misleading, had no relation to Joe Biden's administration, had no relation to what was happening in at the border.
Citing her own words, the woman's own words.
And it just shows...
So it was TikTok where that was...
It was this independent journalist. The mainstream media did not pick this up. He said, I don't know why nobody else picked up on that, because the big detail that got my attention was that she says that the trafficking had started when she was 12. And, well, Joe Biden's only been president for 3 years, and so it made no sense.
It was during George W. Bush's administration.
So why was it an independent journalist on TikTok that found this out? I mean, let's not give short shrift to TikTok.
Why is it the comedy show hosts go back and pull out the clips of them saying the opposite that they're saying now 5 years ago? Because the media is doing a lot shorter drops of news, and they're not really connecting the news together from the past to the present.
Before you are rightfully chastised by Ira, I would warn you not to brush us all with the one brush.
Well, I see that quite frequently. I don't see a lot of the follow-up. Maybe some of the bigger, like the New York Times and others, do. But there's not a lot of that in the moment where they say, well, wait a minute, you said this over here. Why are you saying this now?
Yeah, in the wake of that rebuttal speech and all the criticism that the senator received, including from so many Republicans and conservatives, who did she blame? She blamed the media. And again, like Trump, we discussed before with the AI, people heard the speech. They saw it. To the extent that they could stomach watching it, they saw it. And now she's saying that I didn't say what you heard me say.
Well, on that note, that's all the time we have this week. Oh, yes. Thanks to Barbara Lombardo, Ira Fosfeld, and David Gustina. I'm Judy Patrick. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week on The Media Project.
Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, Barbara Lombardo, the former editor of the Saratogian and a journalism professor at the University at Albany, Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, and me, David Gustina, producer of the Media Project, will also sit on the panel this week. Look for program number 1708. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. Thanks for listening.
Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.